Warning, the Stone Age Gamer includes a lot of bad language. Cover your mother f***ing ears.
Well, hi everyone, we're back for part two of our SAGJGLD Awards. John, are you still here?
I am.
You are. You are still here. You are sitting on my lap and you're being a super cool dude. Are you a super cool dude?
Yes, I am. Did you know that?
I did know that. Okay, so what we're about to listen to now, what you're about to listen to is the second half of our SAGJGLD Awards. If for some reason you haven't listened to part one yet, please go back and do so, because part two would seem pretty weird if you didn't. This is when everybody gave our actual Game of the Year nomination. So this is the big deal right here. So strap yourselves in for another giant chunk of podcast, and please enjoy. John, are you ready?
Yes.
Awesome. Let's go. And we are back. Now it is time for us to give the big ones here. It's time to give away our overall Game of the Year options. So each of us have picked a top three games of the year, and we'll just continue with the order we had rocking before. So, Dean, give us your top three games of the year, including your number one SAGJGLD award winner.
Oh, man, who has the biggest D here? Let's open my tome of scribbles. All right.
Your tome of D?
Yeah, my tome of D. It's full of D. my number three spot goes to Resident Evil 7 Biohazard. This game just released when I January started. It was like January 8th or something ridiculous. So this was straight at the beginning. This had VR support on PS4, so that was a big thing. You could play it on the PC with the Oculus and stuff. I didn't play it that way. I just played it outright, and man, did this game go back to, like, being scary as fuck, and that's why it made the list, is the fact that it was scary. It brought back the horror thrills. It brought back, the survival horror mechanics that you want in the game, and sure, it had some action, but you didn't have to, like, you know, jab it in my face with overly, like, steroided Chris Redfield. It was just a solid game. It was... All right, so you had 4, which took the genre and, you know, sort of reinvented it in a way that made sense at the time. And then they kind of just went with that for way too long. You know, you had Resident Evil 5, which is more the same. Whatever, that's fine. You want to do that, cool. Then they have Resident Evil 6, which was just, stop it. We didn't need another one that was the same exact thing. What are you doing? And then they came out with this one, and it was like, holy shit, you got something right. Congrats.
But not before they came out with Umbrella Corps.
True, very true. And I was going to mention that I think the biggest helping point to this game was that there was a severe lack of Umbrella in the originally released game. In DLC, there's a bunch of Umbrella stuff, but I'm not talking about the DLC. I'm just talking about the regular game. It just felt like a reimagining of, you know, what they could have done if Resident Evil 1 came out now. Like, it was the mechanics make sense for that. It was such a good game. It was scary. Like, I screamed like a little girl when I first started playing this, because it got to that point. It had a lot of really great jump scares and stuff. But, I mean, just overall, it was that tension that built, like, the original Dead Space, where, you know, you didn't know what was going to pop out, what was alive, what was dead. It was just all fucking scary, and it was great. The way I wrote down was it was kind of like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Resident Evil had a baby, especially when you get into knowing the characters better, because they were just so demented and weird and off the wall. Like, it was so crazy. Not going into too much detail, but the family that this takes after, I forget their last names, but
Bakers.
The Bakers, Jack, Marguerite, Lucas, Zoe, and the person that you're rescuing, Mia, have all been infected with this weird virus disease thing, and like it just makes them fucking insane. And it goes from scary insane to like that sort of weird Texas Chainsaw Massacre insane. And it is very, very off-putting and very creepy. And this is what Resident Evil should have been the last iteration. I get with 5, you know, they were trying more of the same, but this was what the series needed. Again, they kind of backtracked when they did the DLC, because they did like a whole weird action thing. Like, I saw a zombie being power bombed in one of the DLCs, and I was like, oh, I don't know anymore. But I mean, this was definitely some solid stuff, and it is absolutely worth your time. And Capcom, I salute you. So for whatever you sucked wind with Marvel vs. Capcom 3, you made it back with the original release of Resident Evil 7. Congrats. Mm-hmm. Does anyone have anything else to say about that before I keep going?
I'm just sad the art style didn't look like Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite.
Truly horrifying.
That would have been truly horrifying. Yeah. So number two. Oh no, go ahead. Go ahead.
Sorry, I just have a couple of things. One is the full name of this game, correct me if I'm mistaken, is Resident Evil 7 Biohazard.
Correct, yeah.
So in Japan, is it called Biohazard 7 Resident Evil?
I think it is. I think they did that neat trick both ways, I'm pretty sure.
How cute. Does the same thing that Sony did with Everybody's Golf this year. Huh, funny. And secondly, Resident Evil 7, I need that game like I need another hole in my hand.
Game humor. I get it. That's a good one. That is a good one. All right, so I'm going to keep... I'm gonna keep going just to keep things speedy, because we spent like 2 hours discussing the top games, or
Go ahead, sir.
Top honorable mention games. So my second one, which I'm sure will make Glenn happy, is Nier Automata.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, it's an overall thrilling plot. It's told from different standpoints as time progresses in the game. It does so many different things right on so many different levels. Like, just initially when you start playing the game, it seems like just like an over-the-top action RPG, sort of along the lines of like a Bayonetta-type game. It's just really insane, crazy action all the time. But then you start realizing that this story that they're telling is super fucking deep, and it stretches into all different games. Like, it stretches into the original one, it goes back before this, they're calling back characters that you've probably never heard of, but you know what, in the end it doesn't fucking matter, because the new characters that you're telling that they're telling the story of and the plot of this game can totally be played on its own, and it will give you a genuine reaction. It is really great, and I think everyone needs to experience this. While the controller layout is a little convoluted, you'll pick it up after a little while. It's nothing that's like crazy ridiculous, and if you play it on the PC, you can actually remap it if you have a Steam controller, which Glenn let me know, which was actually really, really cool to point out. I'm not going to go too far into this, because I know Glenn has some things to say about this too. The story is a huge draw about this game. It's a slow burn because it's about a 40-hour game, and you're playing it over three different sets, three different characters. So like, there's all different standpoints and ways of thinking here that you're going to be getting, and there's even different like gameplay perspectives too. Like, you'll play the first character and she plays one way, the second character plays a completely different way, especially in boss battles and stuff, which is really neat. Sometimes a little annoying, but overall just a really satisfying experience that way. The best way to play this game is going in knowing nothing more than that you just need to beat the game 3 times all the way through. While the side quests are optional, many of them offer some perspective on the story, so I would recommend playing a bunch of the side quests while you're at it too. Normally the first playthrough you probably don't need to as much, but the second and third playthrough are really when you get into the meat and potatoes of the games, and in the side quests as well. You're going to get feelings. You're going to feel feelings. There's a lot of big like moments in the game, and if you're an emotional person, it's okay. It's fine. You're going to get a case of the feels, and that's okay. This is definitely a game for lore junkies and theorists, because there's a lot of stuff going on. This is a spin-off series. If you count the original Nier, this is a spin-off from, I think, the special ending of Drakengard, I want to say.
Drakengard 3.
Drakengard 3 is where this plot line starts. And then it goes into Nier, and then it goes into Nier Automata. So, like, there's a huge rabbit hole of plot that you can follow if you want to make, like, one cohesive storyline, which is really fucking cool. A lot of characters show up from the original Nier, which is great. And I'm not too sure I recommend playing the original Nier, because this blows that out of the water with gameplay and stuff like that. I mean, even story, it's way better. But... This game is just, it's just fantastic, and it was almost my game of the year, but I played something right after this that that kind of touched just a little bit higher. Also, I gave this game the game with the least amount of pants reward, so.
Yeah, I was going to ask, anywhere in the, you know, infinitely deep lore and the meticulously thought out narrative, do they ever explain why she's dressed like a French maid?
They do, kind of.
Oh, cool.
I can talk about it. I kind of like the idea of keeping Dean's kind of spoiler free, and if you guys will allow my discussion of it being kind of spoilery.
Why don't we do that? That's a good way to put it. So I'm just gonna end it there with it's a great game. Check it out. It's my number two, and it's a really, really awesome game. And I'll leave the rest to Glenn to talk about. So I'm gonna go over to number one. And that is Horizon Zero Dawn is my number one game of the year, drop dead. That game was fucking amazing from beginning to end. It's really hard to achieve perfection in this day and age because there's always something wrong. But I think this game came pretty fucking close to perfect. Nowadays, open world games are, you know, they're a dime a dozen. And the problem with a lot of open world games is that you can get lost in the world just doing errands and side quests and finding it difficult to kind of return to the storyline after doing just side quests and crap like that for so long. But Horizon Zero Dawn builds a lot of the errands and side quests around the central plot to make it feel like you're always moving forward, which I thought was a big point to make while talking about this, because that was my problem with Far Cry 4, was I got so into doing other stuff in the game that I almost didn't want to beat the game after a while. Like, it didn't feel necessary. And while Nier Automata has a great story, it can get a little confusing, but Horizon Zero Dawn does not suffer from the same problems. Every time you complete a story mission, you're treated to a cutscene that leaves you wanting to know more every single time. Like, it fills in a little bit more of that puzzle, and after that, they give you another question to answer, and it's like, well, fuck, now I need to keep playing for another 6.5 hours to figure out what the hell's going on, because it's so goddamn good. Is anyone else going to talk about this game before I go too far into it?
Me.
Me.
Okay. Nice. All right. I won't go too crazy on it then.
No,
but,
no.
I mean,
we're so already long.
Yeah. All right. Did you beat the game, Dan?
No, not even fucking close.
Okay. I'm not going to go crazy with spoilers, but basically that this game follows a young girl named Aloy. She's brought up a orphan by a outcast of a society that loosely resembles like Vikings or something close to that, like a nomadic tribe of people. Mm-hmm. And
I'd say it's closer to like the Iroquois myself, but
okay, no, yeah, that works. Yeah, because they're very spiritual with like nature and everything. Basically, the world, for lack of a better term, ended at one point. We don't know why, but it was restarted for somehow in some way. And Aloy is a very curious person, and she gets kind of thrown into the middle of everything. And she doesn't really know why at first. You know, there's all sorts of bad things going on around her, and she's trying to find out why the bad things are happening. But the reason why bad things are happening to her is because she has a bigger purpose, and there is a huge reason why, and it's a huge plot point of the game. There's so many great characters that you meet through side quests, errands and stuff, and just even the main quest, everything feels meaningful. Fucking everything. Like, you'll go from saving someone's daughter, you know, who was just retrieving a spear that her mother had, that she died from one of these stupid fucking robot monsters going around, which I'll talk about in a second, to like the main storyline, which ends up you basically uncovering this whole plot, how the world ended, how it came back, and what you can do to be a part of it. Let's just talk about the fucking robot dinosaurs, robot animals for a minute. These are probably some of the most well-designed and implemented AI in, like, these monsters I've ever seen. They all have great weapons, designs. You can analyze their weak points. You can come at them from all different ways with the amount of artillery you get in this game. It is so insane just to think about. Like, I beat it so quick because I was moving from game to game at this point, so I didn't use every weapon, but I used most of them. And the game revolves roughly around like a bow and arrow type of weapon, no matter what, whether it be like this thing that shoots out like a ton of shotgun type of arrows, or just a regular like strong long arrow type of long bow and arrow type thing. You have trip wires and stuff, which is really cool, and they all have different elements you could use, which add to the gameplay as well. And the animals can range from these crazy ass like flying monsters to a T-Rex that has a giant fucking cannon mounted on his back. And I'm talking about robot T-Rex. I'm not talking about normal T-Rex. Normal T-Rex can go suck a dick at this point, because this thing will fucking kill that in a second. You know, there's even little tiny animals, and they do things that, like, just give them a personality of their own. Just to get off topic real quick, there is a animal called the Scrapper, which it'll take dead robot animals and harvest them, and you'll see it like in the ground, like its mouth opens up and it just starts grinding up these parts of the animal, and it won't notice you when it's doing that. And it's such a cool fucking mechanic, and man, I can't say enough good things about this game. Yeah, just play it. They have a new DLC out, and it's apparently just as good, and it even pushes the story further, which is great, because a lot of DLC is, you know, very little on the story, but, you know, a lot bigger on just adding more world, more enemies. No, this does a lot more than that, and I applaud this game so much. It does so many things right, and for it to be above Nier Automata, which for a while I thought was going to be my game of the year, really just adds that extra feather in its cap. So yeah, that's my number one game of the year. It's well worth any price that it's at. I paid $40 for it, and it was worth that. I would have paid the $60 after playing it, to be honest. It's such a great fucking game.
Wow. Well, I mean, it's at the top of my list for things to play on PS4 if I ever get my hands on one. I've just heard it's incredible. Mm-hmm. It looks incredible to me. Wow.
I went through that really, really fast, but I'm just trying to keep it quick. But also, I get really excited about that game. It did so many things right, and there were so many cool things to look at. I mean, I heard Dan talking about it, I think, on last week's Stone Age Gamer, when he was talking about the corrupted zones and stuff. That is such a cool part of the game, like taking out these corrupted monsters. And there's normally not like a lot of them to take out, but they can gang up on you quick if you're not smart about how you take them out or how you sneak up on them and stuff. And things can get out of hand super quick.
There's been a few times where I've been like, I'm just going to bull rush in here. I don't have time for this shit. And I go, oh, wait, this is a bad idea. Fuck. Abort mission.
Yep. Yeah,
son of a bitch.
I'm looking down at the paragraph I have written for this game, and I love the fact that after all of that, Dean, you only mentioned like two of the sentences that I wrote.
Yeah, I was trying to keep it super quick, and that's the thing. There are so many great things to talk about this game. You know, one person just can't cover it. So, before I go any further, I'm just going to shut up and say, get the game. It's great. That's my game of the year. Stamp of approval. So why don't we turn it over to Glenn? Because I think he's next on the list, right?
He sure is. Glenn, what do you got? Give us your top three.
So number three is Persona 5. And this will be your spoiler warning for Persona 5, so I'm going to go at it a couple cases, if that's okay with everyone on the call.
Go ahead, man.
So Persona 5, a great JRPG. Took everything from the Persona series, made it snappier, more stylish. But I think the thing that was most impressive for me about Persona 5 is that they found a theme being rebellion, and they fucking stuck to it in every aspect of the game. The entire game is about, like, shitty adults and shitty other people and rebelling against what they tell you to do, and it's amazing. Parts of that game still give me chills when I watch those cutscenes, especially when Makoto, who is the best girl, unlocks her persona. It's just such a badass scene. Going back to the theme of rebellion, even the game, as you make better friends with people, the game unlocks more options for you to do, and the game starts breaking all of these established rules from the Persona series. So a core feature of the Persona series is that you capture these enemies you fight and you fuse them together to make them stronger and make them new things, which I know Dan is very familiar with. But it usually has a certain set of limitations that once you level up certain social links and get better friends with people, you just get to pay money to ignore those rules. Everything in this game just bleeds rebellion, and it's amazing. The game starts with an amazing framing device where you're doing a casino heist because you are the Phantom Thieves, and you get captured. And everything about the game starts with the prosecutor, who is the sister of the best girl Makoto, telling you, like, oh, and then you killed this man. Tell me more about him. And it perfectly frames, like, here's this mobster that you're going to go interact with now, or here's this artist that you're going to go fuck with now. And it's perfect framing device. And Jordan, you were going to say something.
Yeah, it's the same framing device that Dragon Age 2 used. I must imagine Persona 5 used it better.
I think it's a great framing device if you have the good writing to back it up. Let's see, what else? The game is so stylish. There's reds and blacks and sharp lines and diagonals and just crazy sweeping motions everywhere. Even the menus, when you open up the menu, like, slaps his hand against the screen and all the things come up. It just breathes that attitude and that rebellion that the game is trying to push in everything. Also cool for Persona is everyone has guns. That's a little different. For those who don't know, the Persona series has kind of like the old Flash RPGs, where you have a certain amount of time per day, and you get to spend time doing things like hanging out with people or going into these dungeons and doing your cool Phantom Thief shit.
Or spending an entire evening to make one lockpick.
Or one cup of coffee. But there's a real weight to the decisions that you make, and there's a real weight to who you decide to hang out with. And it really helps you grow closer to these characters and feel regret when, you know, you have to pick one over the other, or you don't have time to fix everyone's problems. And it really makes you care more for the people around you. And at the same time, it boosts your combat skills, it boosts your persona fusing ability, it gives you more options in combat, which is my other point, is that the battles are so fast, which is incredibly important in a JRPG. They're quick, they're snappy, and as you go through the game, you're always unlocking more options to change your options in combat, evolve that, and make it really, really stops it from being stale. I love Persona 5. Final point is that the music is amazing. Mm-hmm. It introduced me to the entire genre of acid jazz, which is really bass and drum-heavy jazz that I'm absolutely in love with. I know some people have problems with the English, not native English speaker singing English lyrics in all the Persona games, mm-hmm. but that's the spirit of Persona to me. It's just part mm-hmm. of the game to me. Mm-hmm. But even discounting that, the instrumentation in the music is incredible. And I think anybody can go listen to Beneath the Mask from Persona 5 and you'll feel something.
mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to say, Glenn, I was going to, I'm sure at some point I was going to mention to Chris how ideal the Persona games would be for a Waveback episode. You know that you have good video game music when the developers make rhythm games based on the soundtracks of the previous games.
Very true. Three of them now. Yep. Three Persona Dancing All Night games have been announced. That's mm-hmm. how good the music is.
I have a platinum in the Persona 4 one.
Awesome. Whew. Anybody got anything else on Persona 5 before I move on?
It's a game I really wanted to play.
It's It's tough to get it. I mean, this is a game for people who are the hardcore, like, our JRPG fans. It is a game you are going to invest a lot of time in. So either you're going to invest a lot of time in it, like, in a very short amount of time, or you're going to do it over a long amount of time. So be prepared for that, because, God, that wouldn't that game come out July?
April, I believe.
April, okay. I bought it from my girlfriend in April. She got her own copy, I think, a few weeks after that, and she just beat it, like 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, maybe a month ago? And, like, she played it pretty much every weekend, almost every weekend for the last couple months, and she put some serious time into it. I think she ended at, like, 120 hours or something.
And that's common. It's a very, very long game. I do want to make the distinction between, like, I think... It is a very long game. There's no denying that. So you do have to be ready to invest 100-something hours into it. But I do think that it eases you into the mechanics pretty easily. So I think that people that aren't hardcore gamers or haven't played a lot of JRPGs, if they're willing to put the time aside and they're looking for reading a bunch of text and listening to a bunch of voices, I think that that side of casual gamers could get into it and be stepped into the mechanics easily enough, as long as they're ready for the 100-hour investment.
Yeah, you know, I perhaps misspoke there. I think it's just you need the time for it, because,
yes.
I mean, I don't consider my girlfriend a hardcore gamer, and I don't consider my friend Jesse a hardcore gamer, but both of them love this game. Both of them beat the shit out of it, and they both enjoyed it very much. I could easily say this is on their top three.
It's a great game. Great game. All right, number two. My number two is Hollow Knight. Hollow Knight is a Metroidvania where you play a little bug guy going down and exploring a ruined civilization armed only with a nail. And for me, that type of setting is one of my favorites. I love the idea of going into a once great civilization and picking through the pieces and learning little bits about what made it tick, what made it wonderful, and... what brings people into this area and what stories people have heard on the outside of it. So you go into this great bug kingdom as this little guy with a nail, and you just see crumbled buildings and citizen bugs that have now gone insane. And it tells a kind of depressing story just through the things that you interact with, the things you see in the background. Hollow Knight's a very beautiful game. I think it's all hand-drawn or hand-painted.
I think you're right.
There are backgrounds in that game that, like, I literally gasped when I walked into a room. It took my breath away. There's one section in particular where you've been hearing about this city and how cool the city is for a really long time, and you get on this giant elevator that takes you down, and it starts raining, and you see the rain and the city in the background through these windows, and it's just absolutely beautiful. Couple other things I want to mention about Hollow Knight is there's a very deliberate timing to everything in that game. I feel like the combat in that game is more akin to fencing, where it's not about hitting a lot. It's about kind of weaving your attacks in and timing them very precisely when you can. And as part of that, the game very deliberately makes it so that if you just mash the attack button, you hit ever so more slowly than if you time it out perfectly. And it's just a nice touch that lends to the deliberateness of the combat as a whole. Mm-hmm. So I think the combat in this game is amazing. There's the nice quiet lore that you kind of get through little bits and pieces and just talking to people. Like I mentioned earlier, there's great bug gibberish. So as you're exploring this ruined civilization and you're surrounded by nothing but enemies, and it's dark and quiet and there's like very quiet ambient orchestral music in the background lending to the creepiness, and just when you're starting to feel like hopeless and you're never going to find that bench to sit down and save your game, you hear your friend the mapmaker bug humming in the distance, and he's got this catchy tune.
Oh, I love
him. And
you just
want to find him, and you want to make friends with him more, and he's just always there scribbling maps for you to buy, and it's such a breath of relief when you hear that hum and you're like, oh man, I gotta go find that guy. Because the game does something very deliberate where, unlike most Metroidvanias, where you always have access to a map that's always filling itself out, you have to actually go find this guy in whatever area you're in and buy the map from him. And then as you explore and then you rest, you'll note down and draw on your map the places you've been. So it's a very deliberate thing that forces you to kind of explore a bit, find your nice humming friend, and just builds that connection to the characters as well as building your connection to exploring this crazy world. The game saves a lot of its most difficult stuff as optional, which I think is always a nice touch. The game has added, I think the developers added 2 full expansion packs for free, so you're really getting a lot for your money's worth. I love Hollow Knight.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, you laid out the game perfectly. I mean, Chris, actually, I was gonna bring this up when Glenn was talking about it. Was the art direction is akin to something you'd see in the Wonder Boy game that came out in the Switch?
Boy.
Yes, it has that sort of design. It doesn't have the colorfulness because of where you're located. Mm-hmm. But yes, it definitely has that direction towards it. It's a very beautiful looking game. It has a fluid sort of look to it when you're in fights and stuff. Everything that it does is so well designed and well like thought out. It's just so amazing. And I mean, you can put as little into the game as you want or as much, because you know, all these upgrades and stuff are only going to help you in the final battle, which is incredibly difficult. And the way you do the final battle is as well also leads to what ending you get, which is really, really neat. And how much you completed the game also leads to the endings as well. So there's so much to put into it, and it made for such a great story, even though it was depressing. Just finding out like your lot in life was really cool, and I hope there's more of this or a sequel. I don't know how there'll be a sequel, but yeah. I just hope maybe a prequel rather, and go back and explore the city and the ruins and the kingdom and the king before everything went to complete shit, which would actually be really neat to check
that
out.
That would be amazing. The one last thing I want to say on this is that the game manages to do so much with so little. So like I mentioned with that guy humming, he has like a 9-note tune, and that builds this strong connection with this character. There's a little bug that's mining,
and you talk
to her 2 or 3 times, and you build such a connection with her, and definitely nothing bad happens ever. And they all live happily ever after. But were something bad to happen to this little bug that you really only talked to 2 or 3 times, she's just cheerily mining away, it would be heartbreaking. And it's just a testament to the game's writing and the game's style that they can build these reliances on these characters and these relationships with so little interaction, so little writing, so little storytelling, but still a lot of character.
Right. Sorry. There's so many thoughts about this game, but to add one more thing. You know, you're doing a lot of running back and forth because it's just a big, huge area, and you know, you're running past characters again and again. And yeah, you know, this mining character, while you're not talking to her all the time, while she says the same stuff, you know, after the 4th or 5th time of talking to her, at different points anyway. You just come to a comfort of passing her, and like she's doing this little tune while she's mining, and she's there. And you know, not saying that anything bad happens to her, and should she not show up one time, it's just very off-putting and sad and weird. Or like she starts, you know, breaking down, crying or whatever. That never happens. But yeah, should that happen, it's just very off-putting and disturbing. But they did that with so little, and they gave you this little earworm that just kind of grew and grew till like you grew affectionate towards the, you know, these characters. That just it's amazing. It really is amazing what they did with so little.
Yes. Everyone should play Hollow Knight.
What's your number one, Glenn?
Number one is Nier Automata. So spoilers for Nier Automata. Everything Dean said is right. The game has an amazing story. You play through it once as 2B, who is the chick, if you're familiar with the game at all. And then you play through again as 9S, who is her male sidekick. And then yeah, the third.
And surely everyone in the audience thought you were going to say, and then you play as not to be.
Ha!
Ha! Ha! I'm sorry, I hadn't said anything in a while.
Which is a funny joke, but we're not going to get into that. And when you play through the second time, it kind of recontextualizes everything you've seen, and it starts. Your first playthrough starts with this battlefield romp through a factory. And you're, like, killing machines, and you're fighting robots, and you're doing cool shit, and you're shooting guns and lasers. It's a wacky good time. Your second playthrough starts with 9S looking at a machine, trying to give his brother machine water because the brother machine is dead. It's a game that will, like, sweep your feet out from under you and try to break your heart. The thing that makes the game amazing to me is that it does a lot of things with its story and with its gameplay that it tells a story that only games can tell, I think. And it does that through a few ways. So the game runs you through basically different sectors, and each sector has these machines. Let me start over. I'm sorry. So it's like 25,000 years in the future. It's like 25,000 years in the future. All of humanity on Earth is dead. There's just humanity on the moon. And they were killed by these machines that look like Tinker Toys from the 1920s. They're just these brown, like, slow, goofy-looking things. And you're these sleek, sexy androids, super battle bots that can fuck everything up. So you're going to these different areas to do, like, resistance-y stuff and try to fight the machines, and you're seeing all these machines trying to emulate humanity. And as you're playing, especially in the second playthrough, you start to see the game kind of ask the question of, like, what it means to be human and what it means to be alive, because all these humans are all these machines are doing all these human things. These machines gave birth to a weird machine human person that actually bleeds, and all this crazy shit is happening. And the game's not subtle that way, but it's still effective for all those reasons. And intertwined in all of this is kind of a tragic, almost a really tragic romance story between 2B and 9S. There's just a couple things I want to highlight, because I could go on about this game forever. The first thing I want to talk about is that there's...
Well, I don't need to shorten things now.
I'm sorry.
At this point, let's keep all going. Right,
everyone buckle in. I should be done by about 3 hours from now. You get to this pacifist machine village with a friend machine named Pascal.
Oh.
And it's so... yes. It hurts
my heart.
I'm not
sure what
too.
Just happened to Dean.
I was
but
getting
I'm pretty
chills.
Sure Michelle is in the room.
I was getting chills just from hearing Dean talk about the game. Like, it's affected me that much. So you go to the, and you find this pacifist village, and you make friends with all these machines, and there's, like, wonderful music. It's very calm and peaceful music, and there's machines chanting in the background, like little kid machine voices, and it's just very cute and sweet and wholesome, and you just want to help these people out. And as you go through the game, because it's a video game, terrible things happen. But you come to this town's rescue, and throughout the whole game, the leader of the town, Pascal, is always a pacifist. That's kind of this village's thing, is we're going to be pacifists, we're going to tell all the machines not to kill anybody. Pacifism is the way to go. So the end of the game is coming around, and you're watching these machines get attacked by other machines, and Pascal has... taken the children, who are the only people left from this town, this village, and hidden them away in a room. And Pascal is standing outside with you, like, we have to stop these guys. And this is where it does this amazing thing that only video games can do, where it puts Pascal in this giant fuck off robot and gives you control. So you simultaneously get this crazy power fantasy of smashing all these fucking robots like they're nothing, at the same time as you get, like, this heartbreak of this person's worldview is they've proven to themselves that their worldview doesn't work. They're, like, a crushed person at this point, because everything they've based their life on is now meaningless because it didn't work. So it's like conflicting in your heart and soul. Mm-hmm.
So basically it's like if Death Wish, if Charles Bronson had a mech.
Yes.
Cool.
So, like Dean mentioned, the game has a lot of really good side quests that add a lot of really good heartbreak, story background, lore. There's so much to this game. But I want to highlight on some of the humor, albeit dark humor, that the game brings about. For example, there's one small side quest that's just like racing this machine, this speedster machine. And you race him a couple times, and when you finally beat him the last time, he's just like, well, I guess that's it. And he just blows up. And you're like, oh, that's really sad. Like, this guy felt like he didn't have anything else to live for, so he just ended it. He was satisfied with being, this is as fast as he was going to go. Nope. And then the checkered flag robot that's always there is just like, well, now what do I do? And then he blows up too. And it's just, it's perfectly timed. It's so funny, but it's so dark at the same time. And there's good examples of that all throughout the game. There's Master Servo, who is your fun karate bot who you keep fighting, and you keep growing stronger as you fight this guy, and he grows stronger with you. But then same story. Eventually he's like, this is as strong as I'm going to get. It's all over. And then Dean's favorite character, Master Servo, goes away.
God damn it. This fucking game.
This fucking game. It tears your heart out, man. It super does. So
it just, yeah, it builds you up and then tears you down.
I have to know, does Master Servo look like a gumball machine?
They all kind of look like gumball machines.
Yeah, I mean, his first name very well might be Tom. I don't know.
Oh.
I mean, like, just look.
Didn't see that coming.
Google Nier Automata machines, and you'll see kind of what they look like. They all look like dumb, dopey robots with big green eyes. Whew, okay, I'm getting like, whew. Okay, there's one more thing I want to mention, then I'll shut up. The music in Nier Automata is absolutely incredible, and the attention to detail is ridiculous. So there's crazy ambient orchestral music in nearly all the places, except when there's awesome combat going on. But all the tracks kind of flow into each other, and there's four or five different versions of every track, kind of depending on what's going on, whether in the world or just where you're at in the story. And then there's also a hacking minigame, and all the tracks have chiptune versions for when you go and you're hacking while you're fighting and play a little chiptune version of that song. Yokotaro is a crazy person, so what he did was invented what Japanese and French would sound like in 20,000 years, and all the songs are sung in that crazy language that sounds like crazy Latin Faroese fusion aged 20,000 years. But there's some amazing songs in that. Man, I fucking love that game. I could talk about it for Dean. Did I miss anything? Like, I don't want to talk too much about it. I know I gave away the Pascal thing, but there's so much more to that game.
Oh,
that,
yeah, I mean, you didn't give away all of Pascal either. So yeah, you're good, man. Yeah, it's a solid game. I mean, I take it you three didn't play it, right?
No.
I just heard a couple other little things about it. I'd like to play it at some point.
Absolutely. We didn't spoil much for you, so yeah, definitely do it. The only thing we spoiled was maybe a couple side quests, which don't contribute that much to the story. They're just cool quests to do. So yeah, check it out. It's a great game. Yokotaro is a fucking genius and a madman at the same time. But those lines are very, very thin. So yeah, they cross into one another sometimes. Great game. Again, I wouldn't recommend playing the first one. You could just jump right into this and you'll be plenty caught up.
Yes, agreed. So yeah, thanks for letting me gush about Nier Automata.
We salute you, Pascal, our favorite unit of measuring pressure.
Yes.
And let's not forget a really old Mac program.
I think that's more what it was referencing.
Oh.
Yeah, they do make really interesting references in
there's
the game.
There's a lot
which,
of...
Which we
a
won't
lot of,
get into.
A lot of philosopher references as well.
Cool.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Well, that's two down. Jordan? You're up.
All right.
Give us your top three games of the year.
So I think I accidentally gave my top three games also funny award names. Is that all right?
That's fine. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So number three is the Remaster and Recommander, the Far Reside of the Reworld Award, which on top of this extremely weighty pop culture reference, I also realized that for the holiday season, I could also give this the All I Wampa Christmas Is You award. So, yeah, that would be the Crash Bandicoot N-Sane trilogy. You know, folks, if the video game industry has had a cruel mistress before loot boxes, it would definitely be remasters. This generation, the PS4 generation, has just been remaster crazy. It was kind of nice getting like the HD remasters on the PS3 because, you know, it's an HD system. I can play like PS2 greats like Ratchet and Clank or Sly Cooper in 16:9 ratio and with trophies. Like that seemed like a step up, especially since they shucked out backwards compatibility, right? But then once the new systems came out, like, it was a little galling to me that for the longest time the highest rated by Metacritic game on PS4 was The Last of Us Remastered. And for that matter, the highest rated Vita game for the longest time was Glenn, do you know?
No.
Persona?
Persona 4 Golden.
That was a good fucking remaster
yeah. of a PS2 game. So I'm like, okay, well, that's all well and good. And then they said, and here's Devil May Cry, the reboot that no one liked on PS4. And here's both Prototypes on PS4. And here's Metal Gear Rising Revengeance on PS4. And I'm like, okay, we're really beyond the pale with remasters. I think we've forgotten the entire point of what remasters are supposed to give us. And then Crash Bandicoot, of all goddamn people, came up and said, I haven't. And I cannot believe the fun I had with playing ground-up rebuilds of the PlayStation 1 trilogy. I don't know just what I can say. I love that it's both harder and easier than it used to be. Like, the hitboxes are completely redone. Crash is not mechanically a rectangular prism anymore. He's actually contoured. So it's actually a little harder to nail jumps, but it's much easier to dodge enemies. And you can collect gems. Before, in order to collect gems, you had to break every box on the level and not die. Now, you just have to break every box on the level. You can die, but as long as you get all the boxes, then you make progress. And you can also save at any time. If you can believe this, in the previous games, they made you... you had to get a gem in order to have the privilege of saving your game.
I remember.
Saving yeah. is indeed a privilege.
But, I'll make this really quick. There are only two other fun items I can say about this trilogy. Could you guess that this is the fourth best-selling PS4 game of all time?
Wow. Is it really?
Wow. Yeah, I remember when this was coming out, this was a pretty big deal. Because Crash has not made a good appearance on a system in quite a long time. And for them to go back and made a very lofty promise of fully remastering all these games was a big statement, and a lot of people were excited to see where this went.
And, yeah. I mean, these games are fairly beloved. I've never been a fan of them. They don't grab me. I don't think they're particularly fun. I don't think that they're bad games. They're just clearly not for me for whatever reason. But I know that these games have a following for a reason. And so I guess it shouldn't be... I don't know that it's necessarily surprising that they're some of the best-selling games on the platform. I guess it's just sort of a little bit more telling of where we are as an industry, where it's, I guess, harder to come up with good ideas that people are as excited about. I mean, one of the most exciting games coming on PS4 next year is Shadow of the Colossus again.
Which I have that on PS3, and I'm perfectly fine with that version.
But it's like, how can... It's understandable to be so excited for Shadow of the Colossus's remake, but it's also still Shadow of the Colossus, you know what I mean? It's... remakes... You remake the right game, and, I mean, Wind Waker HD sold extraordinarily well on Wii U, and that was a remake of a GameCube title, so...
Which is great, because I honestly thought that the fan base actually didn't really care for that game.
At the time, they didn't, and then here you go. It's now it's one of the most beloved entries in the series. Go figure. Oh. It's the Earthbound effect.
And so the second thing I want to mention, forgive me if this is a little obvious, but I was just so tickled by the sheer number of not just, you know, random fuckos on Twitter, but also professional games journalists who officially compared Crash Bandicoot to Dark Souls.
What?
I think more people compared Crash Bandicoot to Dark Souls than they compared Neo, The Surge, Dead Cells, or Hollow Knight to Dark Souls. Games that are, as far as I can tell, are explicitly trying to draw comparisons to Dark Souls.
Gaming journalism is dead.
So, that was fun. I think I'll just move on to number two. So, my second best game of the year award, I bestow the for meritorious achievement in combining Silent Hill with Fruit Ninja.
Yeah. What?
Go on.
I'm gonna.
Have piqued my interest.
I'm gonna take a wild stab and say none of you guys have played or even heard of this game, because if you had, you would know, you would not forget a half Silent Hill, half Fruit Ninja game. But yeah, this is a little game called Severed.
Severed. Mm-hmm.
I've heard.
Yeah,
of this.
Yeah, Dan knows this game.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And now that you mention it, you're absolutely right.
Thank you. Yeah, this is another PS Plus darling from earlier in the year. It's from the fine folks at Drinkbox Studios, who definitely deserve a previous year's Joseph Gordon-Levitt's Dixie for meritorious achievement in combining Super Metroid with Grim Fandango.
I believe they have gotten an SAGJLD for Guacamelee.
You're goddamn right. And they're getting one next year for Guacamelee, too. I'm just going to go ahead and say that Guacamelee 2 is going to be number 2 next year, and God of War is going to be number 1.
Ooh.
And just throw that out there.
Damn, lofty shots. Predictions a year ahead.
Dude, fucking Guacamelee is dope as fuck, and Drinkbox does not make bad game.
All right.
And this Severed, this was a mobile game, right? Like, this was a cell phone game that got ported to platforms, I believe?
For the longest time, I thought it was only on the Vita. But I actually double-checked before we started recording, and I think after it was on the Vita, it was released to, like, Android and iPhone. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that other platforms have this. It needs to be played. This is a game that takes place in, actually kind of similarly to Guacamelee, it takes place in sort of a Mesoamerican mythological world that is basically the other world from Silent Hill. You are a young woman who is trapped and alone and with one missing arm in this demon cornucopia, and you are on a noble mission to rescue your family's corpses from the clutches of ultimate evil. And just from that weird...
Well, you don't want corpses getting in trouble, really. I mean,
that's very true, Chris. Very true.
I mean, we have already proven, though, tonight that they can be excellent drivers.
That's true.
This game is, honestly, it's a little bit of Might and Magic, too, as well, because it's also a extremely old-school, like, first-person dungeon crawler, like, on a grid. And the combat is, like, this is why it has to be on, like, a Vita or a mobile device. The combat is basically Fruit Ninja. You drag your, you swipe your finger across the screen to coordinate where your sword goes, and the unfathomably weird goddamn demon enemies, they have, like, there are some that have obvious weak points, there are some that attack you unless you counter them, there are some that attack you unless you whittle them down first, and you get swarmed by, like, between 4 and 8 of these things at once, and every combat is this delicate, like, orchestral, like, or like a ballet dance of sorts. You have to know, okay, what kind of enemies do I need to concentrate on? What kind of enemies do I need to swing 180 degrees to parry in time? What kinds do I need to wind up a charge move to, in order to hurt them? And you do not, Reed, do not want to just knock off the weakest guy and then move on from that, because if you don't charge up your severing meter, then when you kill an enemy, you do not get to literally sever their extraneous limbs, horns, and jaws, and tongues, and eyes, because upgrades cost an arm and a leg in this game.
Ha.
Like, you have to spend monster bits in order to improve yourself, and for the longest time, there's a very finite number of fights. So you need to engage in this balletic combat to maximize the amount of currency, essentially. I could speak for 45 more goddamn minutes about the fine details of this game. I know this because I have. You remember how I mentioned that it's been 9 months since my last video game podcast? The last video game podcast I was on was my old show, Story Mode, where I talked about video game narratives, and the last one was about Severed. And so, in order to save time, Chris, may I just email you the link to that episode?
Yeah, sure. I'll throw it in the show notes.
I'd okay. like to point out also that this was first released on the Vita by like a solid 6 months before anything else, which is pretty neat.
Yeah, I'd also do want to mention that this was released on the Wii U, and it's one of those games that like makes all the sense for that platform.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Except nobody owned it.
Exactly.
it's out on the Switch now, which is pretty cool. So, if you didn't pick it up then.
I heard it doesn't use the touch screen even in handheld mode. Though.
Oh, that's a shame.
I could be remembering that wrong. Maybe the game is... Oh, that's right. No, I'm thinking of it wrong. The game is only really usable in handheld mode because of the touch screens.
Right.
So it's like it's one of those games that doesn't really work on the television, which is weird, but still, you know, whatever.
No, I can absolutely understand that with the control scheme it has. One last thing I want to mention about this game. The reason why it's so high on my list is because I am a dilettante when it comes to video games. I tend to play like two or three games simultaneously. Like right now I am playing Everybody's Golf, Destroy All Humans, and Minecraft Story Mode. I just like playing as many disparate games that have very different control schemes so I don't, you know, confuse myself at a time. So to keep my interest going, and so I can, you know, I can guarantee, it's like I more guarantee that I finish a game if I'm balancing out with another kind of game. That's how my cracked little mind works. This game, the moment I was like 15 minutes in, I said I am not touching another game until I beat this, and I didn't. That's an amazing feat for me, and it was only matched this year by my number one choice. The Have I Mentioned I Don't Own a Switch award goes to, well, why be coy? It's Horizon Zero Dawn.
All right.
Nice.
I can say that the road to number one of this game, that is the, you know, the stereotypical obvious, if you don't own a Switch, then obviously you like Horizon Zero Dawn. it was a rougher road than you might expect, because first 2-3 hours into this game, I wasn't really feeling it. I had a lot of problems with the prologue time. Like I thought the story and gameplay balance was really, really sluggish and lopsided. Like, again, I'm the guy who really enjoys video game narratives. I tried to have a show for the longest time celebrating it, but I don't know. I was just... This world is so weird and has so much to unpack, and I don't think they did it quite right. I was not fond of playing as, you know, 6-year-old Aloy, getting rocks thrown at me by Draco Malfoy, and, you know, playing hide and seek with robot ostriches. That wasn't really doing it for me. When the game starts,
sounds like it's doing it for me. Mm-hmm. Robot ostriches.
There are robot ostriches, and they're great.
I have written down here, game idea gumbo. Like, while I certainly have a penchant for describing things by just smashing two other things together, see Severed, I felt like there are like 20 different games that I was being reminded of playing this game, because like the map looks exactly like a Far Cry map with you know, the little animal symbols that tell you, you know, where you hunt whatever these animals are. Just moving around, it feels exactly like how Witcher 3 feels moving around. The bow combat feels exactly like Tomb Raider. You can dilate time with your bow by jumping laterally or sliding, just like Max Payne. Naturally, you have protagonist vision, like every game since Batman Arkham Asylum has had. and you can even see the like the path that the robot ostriches take, just like I was playing Hitman. There's robot dinosaurs in it, you know, just like Transformers Devastation. Grimlock should sue, is what I'm saying. But
it's so good, though.
Transformers Devastation.
That game's awesome. Also,
wait, was that the like the Platinum games?
Yeah. It was a cel shaded.
I forgot all about that.
Yeah, holy it's crap. Awesome. All right,
that was another PS Plus freebie.
PS Plus has been great this year.
Mm-hmm. It's gonna be pretty good next month as well. Every game like this, every open world type game that has like stealth, square is the melee attack button. No, here it's R1. Square is duck. So black. I can't tell you how many times I have snuck up on a robot ostrich just to show him my six squats. it is goddamn embarrassing. Oh yeah, speaking of
which, were
they
ever impressed?
No,
they were by showing you their sharp, sharp fucking claws.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of stealth attacks, you have to buy the ability to stealth kill enemies in this game from the skills menu. What a travesty! Like an open world third person video game protagonist who doesn't already know how to stealth attack. It's like a day without sunshine.
Yeah, so, that is weird.
I don't know. I feel they gave you a lot of other tools in the game to do shit with. Like, the second weapon you get is a tripwire, so you have a way to set up a trap for someone without necessarily hiding and stabbing them in the face.
You can also whistle at people infinitely and, like, haul them from miles away, you know, just like Assassin's Creed 3.
Right, I mean, so that's not to say, you know, it's a little weird that, you're right, the stealth kill wasn't something you already have, but I mean, there's definitely other mechanics that you do get sooner than that that help you do things a little bit more craftily.
Mm-hmm. So then there comes a point when Draco Malfoy is mercifully killed, and the bosses of this of your tribe name you like a seeker, I think it was, and it's the point at which it's just like when Shepard becomes a Spectre. It's like, we trust you so implicitly to safeguard our extremely important laws that we're giving you the freedom to wipe your ass with our laws and just do whatever the hell you want. And that's when this game becomes magical. I also give props to the first time like every Ubisoft game ever, you have to climb towers in order to see what, you know, all the open world shenanigans you can get into in every given area. Well, this game at least throws you the bone in which all those towers are fucking robot giraffes that have aircraft carriers for heads. And it's actually
fucking awesome.
It's a puzzle to climb every one of these. And yeah, by the time I got to that point, I was just in. I cleared my schedule. I threw myself into the endless exploration. Dean, you already mentioned how unique all the side quests are. I just love that there are a lot of side quests, but none of them are the go there and kill the things or go there and fetch 10 of these things. It's like everyone is unique. Each one has a interesting character. Each one usually has a twist. And also, you get to know these people because if you do their side quests before the final mission, they actually help you, and you feel like you've woven a great tapestry to stand against the great enemy. I just loved that feeling. You didn't mention the cauldrons.
Oh, yeah, I mean,
cauldrons.
Yeah, like, this goes into making a difference and pushing forward the narrative and the story. Or just the game in general when you're playing it. So I'm going to turn it back over to you to explain what exactly a cauldron is. But yeah, it's just something built into the game that just adds to the story.
I think the easiest way I can describe them is that they are essentially the optional dungeons of the game, but they're very clearly extremely high-tech relics of the old world. And it's just the feel when you come out of, you know, the wacky wilderness, and then you find yourself in a cauldron, and it feels like I'm playing Alien Isolation all of a sudden, just with the... I love how they look and how well they're designed. I'm especially fond of the one cauldron that you get used to them being like extremely funky multi-level dungeons, and then there's a cauldron that just dumps your ass in front of a giant T-Rex.
Like, surprise!
Yeah, just gotta love it. And one of my absolute favorite things, even though a lot of critics don't like this. I love the scarlet flecked northern stealth grass.
What the heck is that?
I love how you can hide inside a perfectly opaque bush, and all the robot ostriches and robot alligators and robot jaguars are like, "Hey, Aloy, what brings you this way?" And then you're like, "Oh shit, right, stealth grass." So you dive into the stealth grass, which is. It looks as opaque as any other foliage, but it has red flecks on the top that perfectly match your hair. So you can you can just see her head poking impishly out of the stealth grass, and all the robot animals are like, "Oh my god, where did she go? She's a sorceress."
That's amazing. That's hilarious.
It seems so limiting. It's like, you know, you must use the designated stealth grass for the stealth encounter. But I don't know why. I guess it's just the little red fluffs that just make it so funny to me. Like, I know if I ever piss off an Aloy cosplayer, I'll know that if she comes after me, I will check the stealth grass outside first.
Video games need more dumb, fun stuff like that. I'm always in favor of stuff like that.
God, I love fighting the you know, I was a little afraid about fighting like the T-Rexes, the larger animals, the ones that you can't just, you know, stealth kill from the stealth grass. But then I got that bow that has those pneumatic arrows that like immediately shear off all their good bits.
Yeah, and it makes them a lot more doable. They're still incredibly difficult, but they're definitely a lot more doable that way.
Those giant robot panthers that have those miniguns. Well, now I have Jesus those Christ. Miniguns.
Yeah, yeah. and it's... Yeah, there's something else. It wasn't the Sawtooth. There was one after that Ravager, I think it's called, or something. There's two of them. There's one that's like a completely stealth one that is scary as shit.
They're
almost, fight.
They're so much like Displacer Beasts from D&D, so that appealed to me on another level. I think I was getting to a point where I was just doing the open world fuckabouts before the final mission, where I was this close to getting bored with the game and thinking about putting it down for something else, as is my usual wont. And then those birds the size of Boeing 747s dropped out of the sky and smote me with lightning. And I was like, fucker, it's on. And I dedicated 4 hours to learning how to kill one of those damn things. And I rode that momentum straight to the end of the game. Oh, gosh. What else can I say? Well, I have to shout out the fine developers at Guerrilla Games. They put so much love and attention into this game. You can just tell that they were really, really sick of the last 12 years they spent making games about British space Nazis.
Oh, come on. People love Killzone.
Oh,
right?
Fuck
right?
That.
The only one Killzone game I've ever liked was the one, guess what, on the Vita. But I especially liked there's this one mission in which some like poachers are essentially, you know, just cutting off the platinum ivory platinum tusks or whatever of the animals and leaving their metallic carcasses to rot so that they're drawing unwanted wildlife to a settlement, and Aloy scolds them by saying, "Hey, I saw your kill zone back there. What the hell was that?" I
hate to cut you off, but we are entering hour 3 of this podcast, and Dan and I still have to talk about our games. So
mine'll be quick.
More podcast.
More podcast.
Let us move on to Dan. Give us your top 3 games of the year.
All right, number 3, Puzzle and Dragons, because
you really want to make that one of your game of the year games.
I really do. All right, 857 days ago, I started playing this fucking game, and I'm just as into it now as I ever have been. It is still one of the one of the most fun games that I've ever played. It's the only mobile game that I have ever decided to spend any amount of money on whatsoever. And there still continues somehow to be new and interesting things to do in this game. Like, right now, there is a King of Fighters 98 collab going on, which made me super fucking excited because that was not something I was expecting here at the end of the year. You know, you're expecting the Christmas collab to come around, which is shit for the most part. And
still
then
want
the New
Terry.
Year's, I know, but we have Mai, and that's Mai Fu is really all that matters. But, like, then, you know, you're expecting Christmas, and then you're expecting New Year's. But then in the middle of that, they drop this King of Fighters collab, and there's pixel evolutions for them, and they look awesome. The King of Fighters 98 dungeon is great because it plays Rugal's music, which is just fucking awesome. Like, their pixelated backgrounds with the updated character sprite. It's just a fucking dope-ass game. I love it. Whatever. It gets number three. Number two, and I imagine, Chris, that you're going to talk about this as well, would be Metroid Samus Returns.
I will talk about this.
I thought so. So I'll keep it relatively short because
We have also talked about this game. We did an entire episode on this game.
We did do an entire episode on it. But, you know, going back to the earlier point of, you know, how we kind of seem, for a while there, we were mired in this remake cycle of, like, it's the same game but with better graphics, but it's the same game but it looks prettier, but it's the same fucking game. You know, like, they didn't really add anything to it. And that trend has started to change, and hopefully it will be continued into next year with the Shadow of the Colossus complete remake. But Metroid,
I'll tell you, Metroid ain't that.
No. You know, Metroid Samus Returns is a complete reimagining of a Game Boy original game, updated for what modern players would want and expect out of a game. It is beautiful. It is the best reason to have a 3DS at this point. Now that Santa Claus brought a Switch to my house for Christmas, speaking of, did you see the video of my kids reacting?
Pretty
adorable.
I did.
That.
Fantastic.
So good. So good. Anyway, I desperately want to play this game on my television now.
God, me too.
I really, really, really hope that I will pay full price again. And I know that I bag on Nintendo a lot for their, like, why is, you know, Mario Brothers still $5? It should be 5 cents at this fucking point. I will pay another $40 to play Metroid Samus Returns on the Switch, on the television.
In it HD, no less. Because this game deserves HD treatment.
It really does. It is just that damn good.
It's a very pretty looking game, and it would be so much better on an HD screen.
It really would. It is a game that screams to be on a bigger screen, to be played on a television, just immersed in that world. There's so much more that could be done with it, and it really, really gives me hope for the future of the Metroid franchise. You know, we've talked about plenty on the show our love of Metroidvania-style games. I somewhat jokingly said that Guacamelee 2 will be my number two game of the year next year behind God of War. But I am 99% sure that that is going to end up the case, because there is just something just so wonderful about this style of game. And to have a game that was, you know, hard to play originally on the Game Boy, modernized and updated with all the love and care that makes a Nintendo game a Nintendo game. You know, we talked about AM2R the year previous. That was your game of the year last year, Chris, of,
it,
you
sure
know,
was.
How much love was put into that. But it was missing that little bit of Nintendo polish that Samus Returns had. So, just a phenomenal, phenomenal fucking game, and absolutely worth, like, it is worth picking up one of the new 3DSs that are out right now for that game alone, or whatever the new, it's not the new 3DS, is it? What's it called now?
It's the new old
3DS
new,
minus 3D.
Yeah,
the
new
2DS, I think, is the
2DS.
The new 2DS.
4DS.
New New York. Yeah.
All
whatever.
New, all different.
It totally worth it. Worth the price of admission just for that game alone. And my number one game of the year, which, as has been mentioned here by a couple others, is
also Horizon, Puzzle and Dragons.
Also Puzzle and Dragons. such a good game. Let me tell you about all the shit. No. Horizon Zero Dawn. It is simply the... You know, I remember a couple years ago, Chris, you had asked the question of, was Destiny enough reason to buy a PS4? And I had said back then that no, it wasn't. And there have been a few games that have come out, you know, in the meantime. Horizon Zero Dawn is enough reason to buy a PS4 Pro and a 4K television. To buy, like, it is... It is fucking phenomenal in every aspect that a video game can be phenomenal. And it is, on top of that, the first open world game that I've ever played where I feel like the world is actually existing and is not a series of scripted events mm-hmm. that trigger when I walk close enough to them. Like, this is a game where I feel like the animals and the creatures and the other people in this world are simply existing the entire time that I am fucking around doing other shit, that I am hiding in the stealth grass. They are still going about their business. You know, I had mentioned on the show previously about how it's a game that I play with my kids and we just go around looking at shit because there's such a beauty in the design of these things. Like, the tall neck is one of the most fascinating creatures I've ever seen put in a video game. The thought that has gone into each of these characters makes so much sense once you start to understand what this world is, that it's stunning. It is a game where you simply stop and look at stuff for a while. And that just doesn't happen all that often anymore. You know, I know that Breath of the Wild has moments like that too, where you just stop and look around and you're like, my goodness.
No, this is different.
But it's different. Like, yeah. This, you know, I think I had said before too that Horizon reminds me of what Sony's version of Zelda would be like.
Yeah.
And it feels very much like that. It feels very much in the spirit of a Nintendo game, which I think, you know, I bag on Nintendo quite a bit on this show, mostly because I'm playing a character 99% of the time here. But the highest praise that I can give a game is that it is Nintendo-esque. And Horizon Zero Dawn is a very Nintendo-esque game. It would feel just at home being developed on a Nintendo console and being a Nintendo exclusive as it does anywhere else. It is simply fantastic and is worth getting a PS4 for this and nothing.
Man.
High praise.
Clearly, I don't know you guys that well just yet, because I could have put money down that I was the only person who would put Horizon at number one. I thought it was going to be a scrum between Zelda and Mario.
Well, no, I am not a Mario fan, and I have not played Odyssey yet. I do have it. Santa Claus also brought that to the house as well, so it is sitting upstairs. But Horizon is a game.
You also haven't played Zelda yet, even though you've had it for months.
Well, I haven't even finished Horizon yet.
He's been busy killing robot dinosaurs.
He's really good at PAD.
I'm really good at that
game. I give
him
shit because I remember saying to him, if I send you a copy of Zelda, will you play it? And he said, yes.
You didn't tell me
my
when.
Mistake was not, exactly. My mistake was not saying when. But now you have a Switch, and you should absolutely play it on Switch instead of Wii U.
I most likely will. But, you know, Horizon is a game where I don't, like, I will finish the game, but I don't feel pressured to do so. I'm enjoying doing all of the minutia that is in the game, which, if you've listened to this show and listened to Chris and I talk about open world games, the minutia and the side quests and the shit is not something we are into because, and Jordan, forgive me if I'm speaking out of turn, but I believe Chris and I are the only one with kids here. We don't have time for that kind of shit. Like, I get a game, I want to play the story. I'm not going to go over there and save Ricky Bobby from whatever the fuck he's doing. Like, I don't fucking care.
Yeah.
But in Horizon, I do. You know what I mean? Like, in Horizon, like you guys said, every single side mission, it has some sort of gravitas to it where I don't feel like I'm just doing it because the developers were like, let's make these assholes do a fetch quest for 45 minutes because that'll pad out our gameplay. Everything is so well integrated and so well thought out. The fucking cauldrons are the coolest fucking thing in this game. Like,
they are really cool.
When Chris and I first talked about it, what I thought was so brilliant about how they did the marketing for this game was that nowhere in the marketing was the cauldron or the fucking... and I'm tired and I've been drinking, so I forget the fucking little thing on the side of her head, what it's called now.
The focus. But
the scouter.
Yeah, the focus. her scouter. Yeah, it's over.
It's the thing that gives her orphan vision.
Yeah, basically. Nowhere in any of the commercials did that exist. So when you play through the game and the first time you pick that up and you go into a cauldron, it's like, this is completely different than what I thought it was going to be. I thought I was going to be playing this, like, open-world hunting kind of thing, and I thought it looked cool, and now it's so much more deep than I actually thought it would be. And you're right, like, when you go down into these cauldrons and you get into this world that is very, very much inspired, I believe, from Alien and even Prometheus, like, even going back further in that particular storyline of just this kind of weird techno-organic H.R. Giger world that exists. It's just fucking fascinating, and there's never a moment in that game where I'm like, all right, this is the point where they ran out of shit and they were like, here's your room full of guys, you know, which is just the trope that I care for the least in video games, and that simply does not exist in Horizon. On top of all of that, the fact that you can play this game different ways, like if you want to, for lack of a better term, run and gun through it, you can. There's a way to do that, but the game is so much more rewarding when you play it smart and when you use the traps and when you use the tripwires and the it's not a grappling
hook,
but
the bomb slings and stuff. Yeah,
the bomb slings
crazy.
And like all like, there's such a creative way to go about every single encounter that you have in the game, both human and biomechanical, that there's just so much in this world. And the fact that this came from the Killzone guy, Killzone's fine. It's good, but it's Killzone. Like, it's not, you know, like, everybody read that Game Informer back in the day where it was like, Sony has their Halo killer. No, they fucking don't. The Killzone's all right, but don't put that kind of pressure on it. It never lived up to that hype. But to see what taking the shackles off of a developer and giving them the freedom to tell the story and make the game that they wanted to make is just this really beautiful experience that has given us, I would argue, not only the game of this year, but the best game that I've played in probably 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. Like I said, it's very near perfection. If not, I don't want to say perfect because nothing's ever perfect, but it's very near perfection.
Yeah, it can't be perfect. You had to buy the stealth kill.
but I kind of like that aspect of it giving you the option of how you want to play through the game. You know, because as much as I love Metal Gear, there are plenty of times where I'm playing through Metal Gear and I'm like, fuck, I just want to shoot this thing and move on to get to this next weird story scene that's going to fuck take me 25 minutes to get to. You know, like, fuck, I wish there was like an up, you know. But Horizon kind of gives you that flexibility and that freedom. And they built a game that allows for different play styles to still be as successful as any other type. which is a whole other level of impressive.
Yeah, each skill tree is widely varied from the other, so you definitely have different paths to go down that'll lead you different ways to approaching things. I mean, towards the end of the game, and if you do all the side quests, you can get close to getting all of them anyway.
Right.
But for a large swath of the game, you kind of have to choose a path and, you know, see what you can do with all these different moves and skill sets. It's a great game, but our master and commander is waiting here very patiently. So why don't we move on to Chris and see what he has to say if he hasn't fallen asleep?
No, I'm wide awake and I have a lot of thoughts. I'm fascinated by the way this went. I'm kind of shocked that nobody else even mentioned Breath of the Wild, and this is probably one of the only video game outlets on the planet where that happened with this Game of the Year conversation.
It's why we're better than ever.
It's
been
because,
a year.
Yeah, and the other thing is we had to choose. There's just one category that we have. You know, with Giant Bomb, they had a lot of different categories, and for Breath of the Wild, there's a lot of similarities between Horizon and Breath of the Wild, and it's one of the best games on the Switch, if not the very best. But compared to the group of games that came out this year, it's a hard fight for Game of the Year, for especially that, because I think Mario is a better game than Breath of the Wild. I liked Mario a lot, and from a mechanic standpoint and the flow of the game, I think Mario is a better game than that. Not saying that Zelda's a bad game, but I don't know, personal standpoint.
Let's hear what the boss has to say.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I gotta mention my runners-up. I mentioned Doom already. I think Doom is a freaking masterpiece. Wonder Boy the Dragon's Trap blew me away. I obviously love the original game of that, and that was never going to win Game of the Year, but it deserves to be mentioned in that conversation just from my perspective. Yeah. As well as Blaster Master Zero. It was the sequel to Blaster Master I've wanted since I was a kid, and I think it's just as wonderful as a Blaster Master game could possibly be. So that was just personal joy and wonderfulness to me. But my number three is Mario Odyssey. I don't really know what else to say that I haven't already said about the game. It has, I think the game has got its issues. Primarily, its reliance on motion control, I think, is very sad and occasionally game breaking. It's the periods in that game that have brought me happiness are some of the happiest I've ever felt playing a video game. I mean, the celebration at the end of New Donk City, celebration, the big
amazing
event, was amazing. It was just a complete celebration of everything Mario has ever been. And for somebody who this franchise means so much to, that damn near had me in tears of just how happy I was playing it. I was just smiling. I felt like a little kid. It was just amazing. And Odyssey is full of those kinds of moments, and I think it's as good as a 3D Mario game could possibly be, with the exception of it's not as good as a 3D Mario game could possibly be, because there are, you know, certain, it's very fetch questy. I just did a big thing where I was herding sheep from one point to another to get a moon, and it's like that stopped being fun 10 minutes ago when I couldn't get it right. And not because of any sort of real fault of my own, just because it's finicky, you know. The reliance on motion controls to do certain moves is obscene. It's downright offensive to me at this point that they would do a move that is as important to the game as the move where your hat rotates around you is 100% relegated motion controls, even when you're holding it in handheld mode, is just ridiculous. It's right. Absolutely ridiculous. But those are the few things that hold it back for me. But I mean, it's the third best game I played in, like you guys said, an insane year of games. I wrote a whole article on the Stone Age Gamer blog site about how there's just been an absurd plethora of games that are so good this year, and I really think Mario Odyssey deserves all the praise that it's gotten. And that's why it lands at my number three. My number two, just like Dan, is Metroid: Samus Returns. I love the Metroid franchise pretty much as I love anything else in video games. I think Super Metroid, I think, is still one of the most is still the closest to perfect a video game has ever been, especially in its within its format of it tells a story with uttering almost no words, and the game itself is the story. And Metroid 2 is such an important chapter in the story of Metroid. Having it be remade in the vein of something like Zero Mission is something we've all wanted for years. And like Dan said, AM2R won my Game of the Year last year because I thought, well, that's what Metroid 2 should be. And it never occurred to me that something else could top that. And I was so astonished that Samus Returns managed to do that in just ways I never thought a Metroid game could be. And it's because of these little modern touches, like the way that you can aim in every direction instead of just the little things that took it away from what older classic Metroid games are and modernized it, but did it in such an intelligent manner. I mean, the melee counter is definitely a point of contention. I understand it, and I think it could have been refined a little bit to make the game a little bit more shooter heavy than having to rely so much on the counter earlier in the game, because eventually your weapons get strong enough to just play it like a Metroid game. But playing through it a second and a third time, because that's what happened with this game, I just went back and kept playing it. As much as I don't want to pick up my 3DS, and as much as I love Chicken Wiggle, if I'm picking up my 3DS, I'm going to play Metroid again, probably. Like, more often than not, if I have to be playing on this thing, I just got to play this Metroid game again, because it's stunning in so many ways how they took this classic formula. And this is really something that Nintendo did this year in amazing ways on their three biggest franchises, Mario, Metroid, and Zelda, is they just took what worked and then modernized it. And I think just taking that back to basics approach on how to make these kinds of games, and they didn't go at they were as risky as stuff like Other M and Sunshine, but smarter, you know what I mean? And I think Samus Returns is just it's just freaking brilliant. It's as good as one could possibly hope a Metroid game to be, except it's not an HD on my television. Like we talked about in the entire episode we did on Samus Returns, was our biggest gripe was the system that it's on. Like,
yeah,
there are more buttons on modern controllers than there are on the 3DS, and the ability to map certain things to those buttons would do this game a world of good. And there's potential for that if they decide to port this game over to the Switch, which I sincerely hope they do with all of my heart and soul. As for number one, it's not a surprise to anybody.
Chicken Wiggle.
Chicken Wiggle, Chicken absolutely. Wiggle. No, it was Sonic Mania. Sonic Forces, that was my number one.
Oh, God, don't joke. Don't even joke.
Hot takes.
My number one is Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. And the things that you say, that you guys are all saying about Horizon, are very fascinating to me. But what Breath of the Wild did that I didn't see Horizon do. Now, granted, I haven't played Horizon, and I'm not out to specifically say that this game is better than Horizon. I don't want to give that impression because I haven't played Horizon. And I've also come to understand that they're very different in what they do. But to one point in particular that you guys were talking about with Horizon is that you would just stop and be in awe of this world. And that is something that I look forward to experiencing in that game very much. But what I feel like impressed me about Zelda was the points where I stopped and marveled at it weren't at, oh my God, I can't believe how pretty this is, were, I can't believe they thought of that. Like, you look at something and you say, I wonder what's on top of that thing. And it takes an extraordinary amount of effort to get to the top of whatever that thing is. And then you get up there and there's a Korok seed. And it's like, they thought of that. They didn't just put this thing there because it's decoration. They looked at this thing and said, nobody's ever going to climb this. But if somebody does, there's going to be a little something up there for them. And that's one of the things I adore about Zelda, is that there's little bits hidden everywhere. And even if they're not giant game-changing things. They're just Korok seeds. But the fact that they're hidden where they're hidden, and this is why I think Breath of the Wild is so much better than Super Mario Odyssey, because the moons are hidden everywhere in Super Mario Odyssey, and sometimes it's just like, well, there's a bump on the ground, I butt-stomped it, I got a moon. Korok seeds are similar to that in a lot of ways, but there's also so many more of them that are just like, I cannot believe they thought to put something here. Like, Hyrule Castle. If you really wanted to go stupid crazy before you fight Ganon and climb to the very top of Hyrule Castle in the middle of this apocalypse, there's a Korok seed sitting up there. Just nice. Chilling on the top of... That is brilliant to me. That they thought, you know what? Somebody's going to do this, so we're going to reward them for doing it. The other thing that I noticed about Zelda that was really incredible to me was the conversation that was happening all throughout. It just seemed like video games in general. There was this conversation about Zelda constantly about, well, I did this. How did you get past this? And everyone, you would talk to three different people and you'd have three different solutions to the same area. And it was this old school, you know, playground conversations, you know, of just figuring out how to get from point A to point B or what route you took. And it's so nonlinear, but at the same time, every piece of it was fun. The entire, like, I'm going to go this way. Dean, you and I talked about that first Talus that you were able to beat with bomb arrows.
Right.
And it took me ages to beat that guy because I went on a completely different route of trying to fight that guy. And it was fine for both of us because we both just totally deviated after that. And it was those kinds of conversations that kept happening. Like, I just would go online months after the game came out and somebody invented a flying car out of octoballoons or something. Like, and it's this kind of stuff is all over this game. And again, to Dan's point about open world games, we've talked about it a ton on the show where I don't have time for that shit in my life. And that's why I probably would still be playing this game if I had it on Wii U, but because of the Switch, I was able to play it everywhere, and I played it everywhere. I woke up in the morning, it was the first thought I had, it was the last thing I did before I went to bed at night. I can't not remember the last time I was this obsessed with a game, and similar to the way you guys are talking about Horizon, about there was no rush to beat it, there was no rush for me to beat this game. Mm-hmm. I found every single shrine before I even attempted Hyrule Castle. I didn't even want to touch that thing. I wanted to keep it going for as long as I could. When they said there was DLC, I was like, pile that shit on. I don't care how much it costs. I don't want to leave this world. Because there was just every single place I went, every piece of that game, even the little things that were imperfect, every aspect of it, they focused on, is this fun to do? And that was what impressed me more than anything about this game, more than any other open world game I've ever even sniffed in the direction of, is that all the stuff that they did, is it fun to do? They took it all the way back to the roots of the original NES Legend of Zelda of just being, you're plopped here, this is what you should do, but feel free to just go and do whatever you need to do. And they made combat fun. I know a lot of people make a big deal about the weapons breaking, but honestly, it forced me to use different weapons and find different ways to fight things. I mean, geez, I just saw somebody fighting one of those Hinox guys on the island that you go to where you lose all your weapons, and they did it completely differently than I did. I didn't even think of attacking that guy the way that these guys did. I just threw bombs at his feet for like a half an hour. Until he died, because that was all I could think of to do, and that's fine. The game rewarded me just as well for doing it that way as opposed to other ways. It is a masterpiece. I
probably should have rewarded you a little less.
Maybe. Like,
you just threw bombs at this guy's feet for an hour.
The cost was my time. Because, like, I noticed it was still doing damage, and I was like, well, this is the safest thing I can do. I'll just keep doing it. And I did. And he got really pissed off about it, but he couldn't catch me because I was faster. I cannot say enough good things about this game, and it's terrified me at first. I mean, you guys, if anybody listened to the show, and Dan in particular, since you were on it, you heard my concerns of this game. Like, there were a lot of things about it that scared me, and for every piece of it that doesn't look as good as Horizon, it is so unfathomably polished that I think... There was a whole contingent of people online that were like, "Oh, Horizon's better than Zelda. Oh, Zelda's better than Horizon." It's like, I feel like they're just two very different animals, and
they are two very, very different things. And I mean, where Horizon excels and Zelda lacks a little bit is in the story. But I mean, Zelda's never been strong in like a huge plotting story. But Zelda definitely has a better feel for here's a set piece, you can do whatever the fuck you want on it, and go. You brought up the whole point with, you know, you could climb on mountains, you can get to the top of them and stuff. You sure as shit cannot do that in Horizon, and you there are strict boundary lines where you can go in and out of, and if you go out of those, the game will reset you to where you are. In Zelda, it's not really like that. Like, I mean, as far as land goes, sky's the limit. You could do whatever the hell you want, and I mean, that is definitely an achievement for where it is. I mean, just for where I am specifically in 2017, as far as where my mind works, I wanted huge story mindsets, and with the games that I picked, you can see they all have great narratives to them, and I'm not taking anything away from Legend of Zelda, and I respect what you're saying. This is absolutely 100% a fantastic game, and probably I'm one of the best games on the Switch, absolutely. And I mean, if you love adventure games for any console, then
I mean, to what Dan said about Horizon, this is one of the best games I've played in years. I think it's one of the best games I've ever played. And, yeah, the narrative is not what, like, I love simple narratives. I also love complex narratives. And when I think about story and sense of adventure, you know, Wind Waker is still my favorite Zelda game. But what they did with certain characters in Breath of the Wild, I mean, like, I loved Zelda in this game. I was genuinely interested in her in this game. I loved that they made her a science nerd and that she had problems with her family because of that. And I loved the way that they told the story in that you went around collecting these memories and you could do that in whatever order you want or whatever order you found them in. So the story is being told in these fragments that you're left to put together in whatever order you find them in. And that was a really interesting way to tell a story in an open world game like this, because if it's too directed, then it no longer gives you that freedom. But if you have all that freedom, then it's harder to tell a point A to point B narrative. And I really appreciate point A to point B narrative, which is why I'm so excited to play Horizon someday, because that also sounds like the kind of open world game that I could really get into, because it does direct me in that kind of stuff. But the fact that Zelda made having a lack of direction fun is, especially to me, an unbelievably astonishing feat. And I thought by the end of this year that, especially playing Zelda so early in the year, that there was going to be, it was going to be an issue. Like, I thought that there was going to be a real, you know, running between Mario Odyssey and Breath of the Wild, and it's not even close. Like, it's not even in the same ballpark. Doom almost beat Mario Odyssey for me, and Doom has got issues. And as fun as it is, Breath of the Wild was just far and away one of the best games I've ever played, and I cannot believe that my top three games in 1 year are Mario, Metroid, and Zelda. I mean, no matter what else happens, you just got to appreciate how fucking crazy this year was for video games.
It's been a good comeback.
In all the years I've been alive, I don't think there's ever been a better year in gaming. I looked back, I couldn't find one that had so much amazingness in it in the same year.
There was a Mario Party game this year, though.
That is true, but the same can be said of almost every year. I think retroactively going all the way back to 85, there's now been Mario Party games. They've just bled through the timeline because that's how it rolls.
And what's crazy about that is that next year looks to be just as stacked, if not more so. Maybe not necessarily from a Nintendo standpoint, because there will not be a new Zelda and there will not be a new Mario, but there possibly will be a new Metroid on the consoles. Prime 4.
I don't know if it's going to be that soon, but we'll see.
Even if it isn't, like, we'll, Dan and I are going to do a year in preview next week, but I mean, I've got a list like a mile long of games I'm genuinely stoked to play next year.
I am so looking forward to the new Spider-Man. Hi, it's the comic book geek again. Hello.
But I am also 100% on board for that new Spider-Man game, but I am just as on board for that as I am for the new God of War, and they could not be any more fundamentally different in terms of character and protagonist and whatnot. But I'm also just as excited for, and fuck, this sounds terrible now that I've forgotten the name, but again, it's late and I've been drinking. The fucking donut hole game, where like you just go around as a hole and you suck up shit into it. That game looks fucking incredible. And I mean, there's so much coming out, and this year has been so fantastic from a standpoint of, like, if this is the year where it's really like, if you are a particular type of gamer, there was a game for you, and not just like a, well, I mean, I only like golf games, and there was a golf game this year, but there was like four golf games this year that were fucking great.
Yeah, I mean, Jesus, just puzzlers alone, all right? I had two ridiculous puzzlers this year. I had Puyo Puyo Tetris and Picross S. I could not have possibly asked for a better year for puzzle games than that. That's insane to me. And I spent a ton of time
playing Puzzle and Dragons yet.
I haven't even played Puzzle and Dragons yet.
When I think of puzzlers this year, I think of the Sexy Brutal, the game that's basically like Source Code, but for murder mysteries.
I've heard of this. Yeah.
Great game. Glenn and I both played it, and it's a fantastic fucking game.
I mean, geez, like, we could go on for another, like, 4 hours about all the games we played this year that legit qualify as fantastic.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was just going to say, how crazy is it that there was a new entry in the Uncharted series, and none of us talked about it?
I haven't gotten around to playing it yet.
Yeah. That's the thing.
It's right there on my desk.
Because there's so much other shit to play. That is staggering, and it's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I'm to be honest, this year alone got me deep back into video games. Like, I haven't played games this much in a long time. I haven't been this happy about video games in a long time. And it's really something great. Like, it started with Breath of the Wild. After Breath of the Wild, then I moved on to getting a few other Switch games. And then it evolved into PS4 stuff. And then I got deep into, like, these RPG games and everything.
You even jumped back into a bunch of retro games this year, right?
Yeah,
didn't
yeah.
you get a, it was with the Retron I gave you or something? You were playing
I can't remember
what it was, but you got Donkey Kong 94 this year?
God damn,
what a great game that is, huh?
Yeah, I started playing that. That's fantastic. I was playing Super Mario RPG for a bit that I still haven't beaten, but I'm still playing on the side. This year meant a lot for me with games, and I mean, I guess it's a lot with, you know, the people I've been talking to and stuff. I mean, not to mention YouTube, but, like, I've been talking to Glenn a lot about video games, and, like, he legitimately got me excited about a bunch of games and stuff. He's the one who recommended Hollow Knight to me, and that was such a great fucking game.
Yeah, man.
And Nier Automata, like, without him, I would have never fucking played that. And those are two games that are very high on my list. So, it's been such a year and such tremendous titles coming out, and we can only hope that, you know, developers keep this caliber of polish on their stuff. I mean, we had our share of clunkers and stuff, you know, with Battlefront and everything, but
Bubsy.
But that, you know, there were plenty of other games to far outshine those.
Well, I mean, it's well said. This is a crazy freaking year, and I doubt next year is going to stack up to it exactly, but it looks like next year is going to be a damn solid year, and I can't wait to see what surprises everyone has. outside of that. And this is, I believe, officially the longest episode of Starship Camera Podcast we've ever recorded.
Hooray! Yeah,
I'm gonna have to work with Evan to see how we could squeeze this onto our server.
we should just split it up into two at this point.
I think seven
episodes. All right.
All right. I'm calling it. That is our show. Thank you very much if you've managed to make it all the way to this point listening to us and our very varied Game of the Year choices. This was a hell of a lot of fun. I'd very much like to thank, obviously, Dan for just being Dan, and mm-hmm. also thank Dean and Glenn from joining us from Vest and Friends, and thank you, Jordan, for coming to us from the Nonstop Comic Shop. It was a genuine pleasure talking to every single one of you and listening to your mm-hmm. choices on Game of the Year and why, because we're all very passionate about the things that we liked, and that was really, really interesting to listen mm-hmm. to. So thank you guys.
Did that come across as passionate? Because I was making it up.
Well, Dan, everything you do is perfect.
Okay.
Hey guys, if you want to see passion, there was one great joke I couldn't quite squeeze in for my Horizon Zero Dawn review. Can I say it now?
Go for it.
Okay. So the very and it's seasonal too, because there are robot reindeer. They're called grazers, I believe. Mm-hmm. And the first time I ever saw one, there was this big red note on their back, and I was like, "Hey, that's the same shade of red as my new fire arrows. I wonder what happened if one of those met one of those." And so I shot it, and the robot reindeer detonated like a truck full of dynamite. And do you want to guess what I said? You want to guess what I said to nobody in particular as soon as I did that?
Now I have a machine gun. Ho ho ho.
No. Anyone else?
No, let us
do tell.
Throw it out.
And that's how you get more bang for your buck. Good night, everybody.
Great.
Very nice.
Egg.
Very nice.
Tip your waitresses.
Jesus Christ. Well, all right. That, like I said before, that is our show. Join us next week when Dan and I will be doing our annual year in preview. We'll be talking about all the games we're excited to play in 2018. Once again, you can get in touch with us at mail@geekade.com, as well as all flavors of social media that we inhabit. You can like us on Facebook, find us on Instagram at Geekade, subscribe to our YouTube and Twitch channels for all our latest video content, and follow us on Twitter at @_Geekade. You can also find us all individually on Twitter. I'm at Geekade Chris. That's Geekade KRIS. Dan is available at
Geekade Dan.
And what about you guys, Dean? Are you on? You're on the Twitters, right?
Yeah, I'm @Kimono_Vestlord.
All right, Glenn, are you on Twitter?
I am @Shrinn, SHRINN.
And Jordan, can people find you on Twitter?
They can if they're really dedicated enough. I don't think I've updated it in like 4 years. So honestly, if I just start a new one called Geekade Jordan in the future, I'd probably be just as satisfied with that. But I'll cross that bridge when I come to it.
Fair enough. If you're interested in more information about anything we discussed here tonight, be sure to check out our show notes. And while you're at it, you can also subscribe to this and any of our other wonderful podcasts on iTunes or Stitcher, where if you're super nice, you can leave us a review, because any and all feedback is welcome and appreciated. We'd also like to thank our intrepid editor, Evan, for not only staying awake through all this, but making our show listenable for all you folks. And we'd also like to thank Mark TDK Knight for our show's theme. You can check him out on SoundCloud and Bandcamp, or his website, which we will have a link to in the show notes. Again, always remember to keep your eyes on Geekade.com for more fresh original content. That is it, everybody. Thank you very much for paying attention. Thank you very much for a wonderful 2017 in the ocean of shit that was this year. Video games and this podcast in particular have been a high point for me. So a giant thank you to everybody involved. On behalf of myself, Dan, Dean, Glenn, and Jordan, keep playing games.